So my name is Steve Blank, and I'm honored to have the opportunity to introduce a modern American hero. Throughout history, heroes are those who set out on a journey to search and create something new. They follow their vision, they recruit a team, and they set out on a quest. Entrepreneurs are our modern heroes. It's a lonely and solitary journey, with each hero believing that their path is unique. In the last 10 years, we've learned something new about the hero's journey. We've learned that there really was a repeatable path for entrepreneurship, and that every entrepreneur who thought that they were out there by themselves, discovering, learning, and failing, actually had plenty of company. And that what we learned is there are a set of rules. And Eric Ries is the leading pathfinder and the leading light illuminating this journey. I first met Eric as an investor and a board member of There.com, where we made every possible startup mistake one could think about. We built every feature that customers wanted and about 400 others they didn't even think of, but we thought they were cool. We raised a ton of money because we had a great brand and a great story. And we got a ton of press. And then 3 years later, without talking to almost no customers, we launched the product and promptly cratered it. Now, when Eric and his partner co-founded his new company, I insisted that he sit through my class at Berkeley and said perhaps we could actually learn some lessons together. Now, besides Eric being the best student I ever had, I have to tell you that my life changed when he sat in my class because I learned more from Eric Ries than I could ever teach him. He was the first to observe that customer development wouldn't work without agile engineering. He was the first to observe that all these processes needed to be integrated together into something called the Lean Startup. Eric's book, which followed those observations, The Lean Startup, became a New York Times bestseller. He's been an entrepreneur in residence at the Harvard Business School. In 2011, he was named an IDEO Fellow. He's been written about in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Wired, and was on the cover of Inc. magazine. So, for all of you who are on the entrepreneur's journey, I'm pleased to introduce the individual who carries the brightest light, who will lead entrepreneurs on the right path, Eric Ries.
Whoa. Hi, everybody. Thank you, Steve. It's a great honor to share the stage with you. Don't think I could possibly live up to that introduction, so sorry for the inevitable disappointment. I'm Eric. I did write this book called The Lean Startup, and I'm very grateful to get a chance to talk to you about it. Let's go over some ground rules first that are very important. The first one is that I don't want your undivided attention. So if anyone made the mistake of turning their phones off, if you wouldn't mind taking them out of your pocket and your hand, turn them back on. Please do tweet amongst yourselves as much as you like, especially if I start to drone on. It's fine. All I ask in exchange is that you use the Lean Startup hashtag so that you can join the worldwide conversation that's happening about these ideas everywhere. Now, I know it's the last session of the day. It's South By, so let me apologize for the following. I want to share with you a few principles from the book that entrepreneurs are everywhere, that entrepreneurship is management, that the unit of progress of entrepreneurship is something called validated learning, that we can steer a startup using the build, measure, learn feedback loop, that we can hold entrepreneurs accountable with something called innovation accounting. Now, I know you came to what was supposed to be a very exciting and cool presentation about entrepreneurship, and I promised that I would talk to you at 5 p.m. at South By about management and accounting, maybe two of the most boring topics in the entire universe. So I apologize. But I don't know if you guys have noticed, but entrepreneurship has become a little bit too cool lately. Here we are, look around. It's like everywhere. It's the coolest thing ever. And yet those of us who are practicing entrepreneurs know that entrepreneurship itself is not exactly cool and exciting like in the movies. It's actually excruciating, sometimes very boring, and oftentimes very embarrassing. And so we have to talk about the boring stuff, but I wanted to illustrate what I mean by talking about that classic idea of what the entrepreneurship journey is supposed to look like in the movies. Who's seen The Social Network? Quick show of hands. Okay, a pretty good entrepreneurship movie. Who's seen my favorite entrepreneurship movie of all time, Ghostbusters? Anybody? Okay, all right, fine. If you've seen it, now people think Ghostbusters is about ghosts, but if you think about it, it's really a business movie, and since we're at South By, I thought I'd bring a few clips. So here's how the entrepreneur journey always starts. See how this
for
works.
For whatever reason, Ray, call it fate, call it luck, call it karma. I believe that everything happens for a reason. I believe that we were destined to get thrown out of this dump.
For what purpose?
To go into business for ourselves.
This ecto-containment system that Spengler and I have in mind is going to require a load of bread to capitalize. Where are we going to get the money?
I don't know. I don't know.
You're never going to regret this, Ray.
My parents left me that house. I was born...
That's usually how it starts out, and of course we got to have a business plan. It's very important.
Of establishing the indispensable defense science of the next decade. Professional paranormal investigations and eliminations. The franchise rights alone will make us rich beyond our wildest dreams.
There's office space, sleeping quarters, and showers.
Okay, so we mortgage our house, of course, and we go get the office space. Remember the TV commercial, the cool car, all the stuff, the exciting parts of Act One of the entrepreneurship story, how we came to be in the right place at the right time. And as Steve alluded to, we have kind of an important question.
Any calls?
No.
Any messages?
No.
Any customers?
No, Dr. Venkman.
So things are getting tight, and we're starting to run out of money.
This magnificent feast here represents the last of the petty cash.
Okay, so things are looking pretty grim. Now, in the movies, something really miraculous happens right at this moment, right? When it is darkest before the dawn. Anyone remember this scene from the movie? Our first customer walks in the door, and then...
We go!
It's going to be great. An actual customer comes in the door. Now, before we get onto the rest of the movie, I just want to ask this question, first of all. Does anyone remember why this first customer walked in the door right at that very moment? It's because Zool decided to invade Manhattan right then. If you think about it, Zool had really good timing. Aren't we very grateful that Zool invaded right then? A year earlier or a year later, there's no Ghostbusters. And in fact, what I have observed is that most entrepreneurs are, even as we speak, waiting for Zool. So we'll get back to that. I know none of you would ever make that mistake, but maybe you have a friend. And the most important part of the movie for our purposes today is what I call the photo montage, always right in the middle. Not a lot of dialogue in the photo montage. It looks like this.
Something strange in the neighborhood. Who you gonna call?
Ghostbusters!
Something weird and it don't look good. Who you gonna call?
Hi, this is Larry King. The phone-in topic today, ghosts and ghost busting. The controversy builds, more sightings are reported.
So as soon as you get your first customer, that's basically it until you're on the cover of Time magazine. Never takes more than 2 minutes. It's really nice. And then we can get Act 2 out of the way, and we can move on to Act 3, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, you know, who sues who. Pick your favorite Act 3 from your favorite movie, or, you know, maybe we'll decide to cross the streams.
Excuse me, Egon. You said crossing the streams was bad.
Cross the streams.
You're going to endanger us. You're going to endanger our client, the nice lady who paid us in advance before she became a dog.
Not necessarily. There's definitely a very slim chance we'll survive.
I love this plan. I'm excited to be a part of it. Let's do it.
Does Bill Murray have a great reality distortion field or what? That's what entrepreneurship looks like in the movies. And for those of us who've done it, it is a little bit true to life. But the things that we like to talk about entrepreneurship are in Acts 1 and Act 3, how you come up with a great idea and like what kind of car you're going to drive after the whole thing is successful. And that's fine. That's fun. But actually, the decisions that ultimately determine the success of startups happen during the photo montage in that brief Act 2. Now, how come we never see those activities in the movies? It's because they are too boring. right? Who's ever been in a product prioritization meeting? Okay, whoever feels like that would make a really good movie, right? It's the tough questions like deciding whether to pivot or persevere, which customers to listen to and which to ignore. Those are the things that never happen in the movies because they're frankly too boring. But if we're going to get better at entrepreneurship, then we have to get better at the boring stuff most of all, which is why we're going to talk about some pretty boring topics. So, too bad. So first, that entrepreneurs are everywhere. What is a startup? We have this image in our mind. It looks like the Ghostbusters in a university lab or in a rundown garage. But I believe that what makes you an entrepreneur is not whether you eat ramen noodles or not or what kind of office you're in, but rather whether you are trying to create something new under conditions of extreme uncertainty. And the most important part of that definition is what it excludes. It doesn't say how big your company is or what sector or industry you work in. It just says that we don't yet know what we don't know, which is a fancy way of saying that a startup is an experiment. But not an old 20th century style experiment that's about can something be built. The question of our time is instead, should it be built? Because we can build anything that we can imagine. And the problem is that as an entrepreneurship ecosystem, we are busy wasting people's time on an industrial scale. And I brought a demonstration. We're used to the idea that startups fail, that that's a necessary part of taking risks. But I think there's something wrong with that idea. Who remembers Web 2.0, back when that was still cool? Anyone? Yeah, I think that was cool at South By for like 5 minutes. And during those 5 minutes, a graphic designer put together this patchwork quilt of all the incredible Web 2.0 companies that were going to change the world. And then 3 years later in 2009, a different graphic designer was feeling something slightly different when they made this updated version of the chart. That's in just 3 years of Web 2.0. And again, there's not one single company on this chart where you'd say, boy, I wonder if that can be built. Right? Someone pitches you a social network for dogs. Can it be built? Sure. But will the dogs eat the dog food? Haha. So this failure is not about us taking too much risk. It is about us building the wrong things. And therefore, the people who are working on these companies and the investors, the employees, the founders, everybody, are basically wasting their time. These companies are doomed from the start. And I really don't think it has to be that way. Or as my friend Hugh McLeod, that you know as Gaping Void, put to welcome to failure. Now, I understand that you're not going to fail, you know, because your company's going to be fine, but the person to your left and to your right, maybe. Right? That's what we have to talk about. Now, I know it's not fun to talk about failure because it's not cool, it's not exciting, it's a little bit boring, but anyone who's telling you the truth about entrepreneurship is going to be talking to you about failure. And if I'm being totally honest, I should admit, as Steve previewed, most of the companies that I've built have failed. And I know when you're on a big stage like this, you're not supposed to say things like that, like, hi, I'm a big failure, and if you follow me, you too can be a big failure. But that is the truth. Failure is a necessary part of entrepreneurship. But it has to be somebody's fault that these companies failed, and it obviously can't be my fault. And it's ideal if it's the fault of someone who's dead. You'll see why in a second. So I blame this guy, Frederick Winslow Taylor. He invented something that he called scientific management, but we just call management. And the problem with the world as we live in it today is that what he is credited with inventing is to us so obvious, we can't imagine that it had to be invented at all. Like the idea that work should be done as efficiently as possible. I want you to visualize trying to write a polemic in favor of the thesis that work should be done as efficiently as possible and ask yourself, who's on the other side? Who are you trying to convince? He invented something called the task plus bonus system that we call tasks. And here's the crazy idea. A manager could take a big project, break it down into a series of tasks, farm those out to functional specialists who work in functional departments. And then if they found a way to do their task better than expected, they should be paid a bonus rather than being penalized. Pretty exciting, right? You got to ask yourself, who thinks they should be penalized? Well, in the 19th century, state-of-the-art management was, if you found a way to do a task better, what do we know about you? That you're a person of low moral character. Because you could have been doing it the better way this whole time, but you didn't. So you should be punished. And furthermore, what do we know about your coworkers who are all still doing it the old way? Well, they should all be punished. I want you to think about that. Collective punishment for productivity improvement. Sound familiar to anybody? We would never do it today. We think that's ridiculous. And yet that is what we currently think of as management. The problem is that this kind of management relies on planning and forecasting in order to work. We all now take it for granted that a manager who is ahead of plan, you know, if you're ahead of plan, your stock price goes up, managers get promoted. If you're behind plan, you get fired, demoted, stock price goes down. But forecasting and planning only work if you have a long and stable operating history from which to make the forecast, right? And yet, who feels like the world is getting more and more stable every day? I never get it. Oh, I got one hand. That's the first time in all the years I've been giving these talks. For most of us, anyway, the world is becoming increasingly uncertain, and so the tools of general management are not working very well. And what I want to convince you of today is that entrepreneurship is management. It's just not the Fred Taylor-style general management of the 20th century. Rather, we need a new toolkit of entrepreneurial management that can work in these conditions of extreme uncertainty that is the soil in which startups grow. So probably the most important single concept from the toolkit of entrepreneurial management is this thing called the pivot. I know this has become one of the most overused buzzwords in the entire world, for which I apologize. I kid you not, I saw this cartoon the other day in the New Yorker magazine. I don't know if you can read this caption. It says, "I'm not leaving you, I'm pivoting to another man." Sorry about that. So it's gotten a little out of control, but I won't apologize too much, because you cannot understand entrepreneurship if you don't have the concept of the pivot. Because if you get the real stories, not with all due respect the garbage you read in the press, but the real stories of what actually happened to successful companies, what you will discover is that successful founders did not have better ideas than the unsuccessful founders. They were equally bad at the beginning. What makes successful founders successful is that when they run into difficulty, they don't just give up and go home, but neither do they persevere the plane straight into the ground through stubbornness. They're able to keep one foot anchored in what they've learned while changing one other thing about their business. And the premise of the Lean Startup is very simple. If we can reduce the time between pivots, we can increase our odds of success before we run out of money. So we talk about startup runway, usually as how much time do you have left before the plane crashes. But I want us to reimagine runway as not how much time do we have left, but how many opportunities to pivot do we have left. And that's why the Lean Startup makes companies more capital efficient. Because if you can decrease the time between pivots, you can magically increase runway without having to raise more money. Does that make sense? All right. I want to talk about this concept of validated learning. And Steve already alluded to one experience that screwed this up. We built at the company that Steve described, where we raised tens of millions of dollars and set it basically on fire. We did something I call achieving failure. And my question for achieving failure is this. If we are busy building something that nobody wants, why on earth are we so proud of having done it on time and on budget? Right? It's like we're driving a car straight off a cliff, but bragging about the excellent gas mileage we get as we go over the side. And yet go to your favorite startup board meeting, not yours, of course, but your friends. Go to your friend's board meeting, and what's being discussed is, are we on time, on budget? Did we hit our milestones? Have we accomplished our goals? And at the company that Steve mentioned, we had this beautiful business plan. I mean, it would make you weep to read. It was really amazing. And it had this incredible chart. It had this hockey stick-shaped graph that predicted what was going to happen to the future of the company. We launched the product, and we had that nice, long, flat part, and then boom, it turns up and to the right. Right? You've ever seen those kind of plans? And when we were on the long, flat part, you know, 2 months in, 6 months in, 9 months in, we were like, this plan is genius. We're right on track. Any minute now, we'll have that up and to the right. But how do you know, or does your friend know, how do you know if you're going to be on the long, flat part forever or you're going to turn up and to the right? Well, we call it Lean Startup because of some ideas from Lean Manufacturing, and I want to give credit where it's due to these gentlemen who created what was called the Toyota Production System in Japan, eventually became known as Lean Manufacturing, which was an effort to eliminate waste in companies. Deming is famous for having said that the customer is the most important part of the production line. And that is really important. If you're in a factory, you can visualize your whole company and say, which of the activities we do our customers care about? Those are the value-creating ones. And which ones do they not care about? Those are waste. But here's the problem. As entrepreneurs, we often don't know who the customer is. So if you look at a lean system like extreme programming, most of the agile systems that, for example, would have you have a customer sit next to the engineer so that they could get real-time feedback on what they're building, who do you sit next to the engineers if you don't know who the customer is? So that's why we are wasting people's time, is we only have beliefs, or what we would call in science, hypotheses about who the customer might be. And if you believe what I'm saying about the unit that entrepreneurship is about extreme uncertainty, then I hope you'll agree that learning is the key unit of progress for entrepreneurs. We want to figure out, are we actually on path to build a sustainable business or not? Now, after we did that horrible failure that Steve described, we built a company called ImView. And I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail about the business, but it was a 3D avatar company. We wanted to bring the technology of 3D avatar to what was then the hot new social technology called instant messaging. So it dates us a little bit. This is 2004. We wanted to build the next AOL back when that was still cool. And so we thought, all right, everyone knows instant messaging is a network effects business, right? Everyone's already on an instant messaging network, so to switch to a new one, that would require bringing their friends with them, so that's a high switching cost, therefore high barrier to entry, right? And so we had that strategic dilemma. We said, here's a brilliant idea. We'll build an instant messaging add-on that will interoperate with all of the existing IM clients, and then you won't have to bring your friends with you or loan a new client. And even better, when you choose to go 3D, you'll automatically be inviting one of your friends to chat with you. Doesn't that sound good? Can't you just visualize our invites spreading virally through the whole instant messaging network? When I talk in MBA classrooms, by the way, this is the only part of the talk people nod along to. They're like, that sounds like good strategy. Yeah, I like that. And there's just this itsy-bitsy problem with the strategic analysis I just gave you, which is that every single thing I just said is false. It is not true, but it sounds really good. It sounds good are the two most dangerous words in entrepreneurship. So we built this product. I think we gave ourselves a deadline of 6 months to build this product and ship it to customers. We thought that was really fast. And, you know, as the months went on, I was the CTO of this company. I was in charge of building this software. And to be totally honest with you, the software kind of sucked. In fact, I would go so far as to say it would be more likely to crash your computer than it would be to give you a 3D avatar experience. So it was a little bit nerve-wracking to think about launching it because I had this image in my mind that the next day some journalist would see this horrible product, would crash their computer, and there'd be big headline news. Idiots at IMVU don't know what quality means. Never hire this guy again, and there's my mugshot, right? So I was nervous. But we were more nervous of building something that nobody wanted, and of course we had Steve on our board encouraging us to ship. So we put it out there, and I kid you not, I was actually relieved when it turned out that no one would even download it. So actually, nobody found out how bad it was. It didn't crash anybody's computer. And I was like, dodged a bullet. And then I was like, wait a minute. What is wrong with this picture? Why did I spend 6 months building something that nobody wants? And to make a long story short, we realized that we had to pivot the business. We can discuss in the Q&A if anyone's curious to know more. But we had to pivot the business into a standalone instant messaging network, a completely different strategy. And that, first of all, it's something I want you to really internalize. A pivot is a change in strategy without a change in vision. So we didn't give up and go home. We still wanted to bring 3D avatars to people, but we realized that strategic analysis was wrong. And so it sounds really clinical and simple. It's like, oh, we had to pivot. Okay, big deal. But now sympathize with me for a minute, if you would. Okay, who wrote the software that had to be thrown away during the pivot? Yours truly. And I was basically depressed because I was all agile. You know, I'd done everything waste-free to eliminate waste, and yet here I was committing the biggest waste of all, building something that nobody wanted. And I thought, why did I even have to be here? If all my work got thrown away in the end, couldn't my co-founders have done all the work and just I could have been on a beach having vacation, right? That seems like it'd be just as useful. And those of you who've ever been a manager inside of a company will know the excuse I used to justify this failure, because there's always one last excuse you can always use when you're scraping the bottom of the barrel, running out of excuses. You can always say, well, it was a good learning experience. Right? I mean, at least we learned this important thing about customers so that we could pivot. And that's actually true. That's why in most managerial circles, a manager who claims to have learned something is about to be fired. It's a horrible excuse that anybody can use. It means you either didn't make a very good plan or you made a good plan and didn't execute. So that's pretty terrible. But I used the excuse to make myself feel better. I was like, okay, well, we did learn this important thing, until I had this thought, which was like, wait a minute. If my goal the last 6 months was to learn this important thing about customers, why did it take 6 months? Why did I have to support, for example, 12 different instant messaging networks out of the gate? Would the learning have been the same if I'd supported only six, or only three, or only one? Namely, that no one wants to download the product? Yeah, learning's the same. But the difference between 12 networks and one is an order of magnitude reduction in the amount of code I would have had to write. So that was pretty depressing. But then I had this thought. This is really what upset me. I said, wait a minute. What if I had just created a single web page with a screenshot of the product I proposed to build and a giant download button? Would I have to have created page two where I apologize that the product was not available yet? No. A 404 would have been just fine. Why? Because people wouldn't download the product. That means they literally would not click the download button. And that really pissed me off. Because what did it say on my business card? Like every entrepreneur, I had a business card, okay? And what did it say? Eric Ries, Chief Technology Officer. It did not say Chief One Page Landing Page Officer that some crappy designer could have done in one day. No, it did not say that. And I thought, my job is to create technology. So how is it possible that the company could get the same benefit from one day's work by a designer as my 6 months building incredible technology? That is really the... It undermines our sense of functional specialty that comes from Fred Taylor. And yet my claim to you is if you work in a startup, your job title is entrepreneur. And your job description is do whatever it takes to make the company successful. And it doesn't matter what your job title was before. And it doesn't matter if you were in marketing or engineering or sales or operation. It doesn't matter. Now, congratulations, you're an entrepreneur. None of that matters at all. So how do we think about this concept of validated learning? How do we tell how to get validated learning? And how do we, most importantly, validate it? We need this concept called the build, measure, learn feedback loop. In manufacturing, there's something called the fundamental cycle time, which they try to minimize, which is how much time elapses between when a customer places an order and we ship them a high-quality product. For entrepreneurs, our cycle time is different. Our question is how much time elapses between when we have an idea and when we have learned whether that idea is brilliant or, let's face it, more likely, crazy. And everything we do as entrepreneurs should be geared towards getting through this feedback loop as quickly as possible. In fact, this is the way we get out of this really annoying problem that just drove me crazy as an entrepreneur. You go hear famous entrepreneurs speak, you read books, you get advice, and the advice always goes like this. Listen, everyone knows Steve Jobs wouldn't launch a product unless it had really good design. So make sure it has good design. But also, if you look at like Craigslist or eBay or a lot of other important companies, their design sucks, so don't worry about design. You're like, okay. And the next speaker's like, listen, it has to be scalable from day one. You don't want to be Friendster and launch something that doesn't scale, and then you know not only does the company fail, but it's your fault. So make sure you have a good architecture. And then someone else will be like, you know, Facebook, MySpace, none of those guys had good scalability. They just figured it out as they went. So you're like, got it. Make sure it scales, but don't worry about scalability. Yes, and I used to remember, Steve and I used to joke about this. You'd turn to your CEO in that situation, and he'd be like, we just got those four pieces of advice. What do you want me to do? He'd be like, yes, execute. I'm like... those are four contradictory ideas. It's like, that's your problem. You figure it out. You're the CTO. So it's pretty irritating. How do you know that what worked for that famous person will work for you? And this is the heuristic I want you to think about. Whatever advice you're given, ask yourself, does it help me learn faster? Because most of us as functional specialists and especially engineers have been trained to take a specification document and say, how do I get this product built with minimum effort? And we have to retrain to say, how do I get the learning this experiment represents with minimum effort? And that's a really different way of thinking. So for example, the concept we call it minimum viable product. That's really what this is. How do I figure out what the smallest experiment I need to build is? And if you take a lot of today's famous companies and you look at how they started, you will see these MVPs that are they're really bad from our point of view. So for example, consider a company like Groupon. When they started, they were not, Groupon. They were this thing called The Point, this petition software. And they spent a year and $1 million trying to build a product. It didn't work. They decided they had to pivot, and they decided to try the social coupon thing. Anyone remember what the first Groupon was? It was 2-for-1 pizza in the pizza restaurant in the lobby of their building. Now, I know. I've been to that pizza restaurant. It's pretty good. And they just created a WordPress blog called Groupon. They said, hey, 2-for-1 pizza. They literally were sending people coupons by hand that they made on a PDF maker on their Mac laptop, okay? Not any kind of high tech. If my memory serves, they sold 20 free pizzas. Now, I'm not that smart. You're probably smarter than me. But if I had been there and I was sitting next to them and I said, wow, 20 free pizzas, obviously this is going to be the fastest company in history to $1 billion in sales. Right? I'm sure it's obvious to you, but to me, it would not have been. Now, here's the question. How come they were so excited about 20 free pizzas? The answer is that they had just spent a year trying to get people to take any collective action whatsoever, and they understood how difficult it was. It was the failure that made the pivot possible and helped them understand what the MVP would have done. But if they had taken a second year to build out a complicated high-tech solution, they would have been dead before they would have gotten that opportunity. So by going through this build, measure, learn feedback loop faster, they were able to find the sustainable business before it was too late. Now, there are a ton of different techniques, continuous deployment, 5Ys, Steve mentioned customer development, a lot of specific techniques that are very important to Lean Startup, and you can learn about them all online. Each of these techniques they operate at one stage of the feedback loop, but I believe they have the net effect of minimizing total time. But I don't want to teach you techniques today, because actually none of these techniques, technically speaking, is very hard. What is hard is adopting the mindset change that is required to think of learning as our primary unit of progress. It sounds good. Who's not for learning, right? Of course I'm for learning. But if you believe me, if you actually go there and say, wait a minute, if learning is my most important unit of progress, then what about making money or serving customers? Are those my unit of progress? No. And then most entrepreneurs are like, wait a minute, I did not sign up for that. Okay? But that's what we're talking about. Learning how to build a sustainable business is the only thing that matters. Now, before I take questions, I want to leave you with one concept that I know you've been dying to hear about, which is accounting. Because I promised we would get to the most boringest, lowest possible moment, and this you've now arrived. But we have to talk about accounting because Accounting is the way we hold people accountable in modern companies. And right now we're having a crisis in our accounting paradigm. I mentioned Groupon. You'll notice in the press that people are actually having a debate about whether Groupon is either the fastest growing, most profitable company in history or a giant Ponzi scheme. And you think about that, like, we really ought to be able, like, it's not, we're talking about like A plus or A minus, we're saying like best company ever or worst company ever, and we can't decide because modern accounting simply doesn't know how to handle fast growing companies. It doesn't handle uncertainty. And here's the root of the problem. You know, you saw in Ghostbusters, you see in any entrepreneurial story, there's always somebody who holds the entrepreneur accountable. And it doesn't matter if you're a corporate entrepreneur and it's your CFO, or you're a venture-backed company and it's your VC, or you're a garage entrepreneur and it's your spouse. Okay, the negotiation always starts like this. CFO, honey, I got this great idea. And if you just give me, you know, a year and all of our life savings, or, you know, $1 million and this team of five, I promise you, boy, the most amazing results, right? We are going to be rich beyond our wildest dreams. A franchise will make us billions of dollars. You start making these promises about all the metrics we will have up and to the right, crazy hockey stick 1 year from now. Now, get the money. Everything's good. Now, let's fast forward 1 year later. What do we know for sure in real life? We know for sure that the money got spent right on time, every time. We know for sure that everyone was busy during this time. Keeping people busy is an entrepreneurial superpower. And if we're being honest, we will probably admit that the giant numbers are not exactly forthcoming. For example, when we promised millions of customers, maybe we only have thousands. When we raised money for InView, we used to have this hockey stick shaped graph that went up from like a couple $100 a month all the way up, I think, to $7,000 a month, but had the perfect shape. And we take it into VC offices and they'd be like, wow, this is really exciting, hockey stick. What are the units on that graph? Is that in thousands? And we'd be like, no, sir, that's in ones. And we got thrown out of a lot of VC offices. So the results are not exactly, the vanity metrics are not exactly as promised. Now, what does that negotiation look like? You know exactly what I'm talking about, right? It's like, CFO, or honey, remember when I promised all those amazing results? Well, okay, we didn't exactly hit any of them. And when I said we have millions of customers, actually, we only have a few hundred. And when I said we'd have billions of dollars in revenue, only a few thousand. But, see where I'm going with this? We have learned so much. And if you just give me one more year and a team of 25 and like $5 million this time, boy, do I promise you the most amazing results. Okay, now, we all know that's an entrepreneur that's about to get fired, right? You walk into a board meeting and say that, you are doomed. So do not try that at home. But we like to heap scorn on those CFOs and VCs, the vulture capitalists who are constantly killing promising innovations right when they were at the point of learning the most important thing. But I want you to see it from their point of view. If you come in with pathetically small numbers, your VC cannot tell the difference between whether you spent that year on the brink of huge success or you've just been goofing off doing nothing. Okay, remember, greatest company ever, worst company ever, can't tell the difference. That is total paradigm breakdown. So as a result, our negotiations with those who hold us accountable are full of storytelling and movie making and all kinds of BS, instead of an objective assessment about whether we are actually learning things that matter. And I really think we have to stop doing that. So I want to talk about innovation accounting. And I think it is such an important change in the way we hold entrepreneurs accountable. Now, a lot of this was inspired by this chart, which is from a very important book called The Toyota Way, about how lean manufacturing works in the Toyota context. And the realization that this chart had was that most of the time we talk about process and culture, that those are our favorite topics. We can see it, taste it, touch it. It's really fun. But actually, what enables those processes is Toyota's commitment to long-term thinking. That's the Toyota way. And I started to think about, well, what is the startup way? And I drew this diagram. Most of the time, when we talk about startups, we want to talk about the top parts of the pyramid, people and culture, right? How do I find the right co-founder? How do I find the right engineers? How do I find those innovative, great people who work for my company? Or sometimes, if we're feeling advanced, we'll talk about culture. Like, for example, my favorite piece of entrepreneurial advice is that you should really focus. It's like, yeah, no duh, right? Telling an entrepreneur to focus is like telling someone who's overweight they should lose weight. Like, yeah, thank you for that advice, but how? That is the question. That's a process question. How can I engineer my company so that we are focused? But my claim is that all the process changes in the world will not make a difference if we don't also change the accountability system. Because if you're being held accountable to vanity metrics, at the 11th hour, you will always face the overwhelming temptation to buy a Super Bowl ad. Because you got to juice those numbers to have something to show or you're doomed. And that's where we get a lot of what I call success theater, which is the energy we work put in as entrepreneurs to making ourselves look successful. Every ounce of energy we put into success theater is an ounce we could have put into serving customers but didn't. So innovation accounting works like this. I'm going to do a quick exercise. Raise your hand and keep it up if you've ever written a business plan. Okay? Hands up. Keep your hand up if the business plan had a spreadsheet in the back. Keep your hand up if the spreadsheet in the back made predictions for revenue in year five. Keep your hand up if the revenue in year five was at least $100 million in the spreadsheet. Hands up if you actually made $100 million by year five. Anybody? Any hands? I can always get all the hands down with that. It's amazing. We're so good at making plans, not as good at making those companies. Now, if I had your plan in front of me, and I looked in the spreadsheet in Appendix B, here's my prediction. It's an 8-point font, so I got to pull out my magnifying glass. And I look in there, and I find some box, and the box will say 10%. And if I trace my finger back all the way to the left, what is this 10%? It will say percentage of customers who signed up for the free trial. Does that sound familiar to anybody? Okay, here's my claim. This is not an assumption that should be stated in 2-point font in Appendix B. This is a leap of faith assumption upon which our entire business depends. It should be in giant red letters on a huge poster on our wall. Why? What happens to your beautiful spreadsheet if I change the 10 to a 0? Think about every other number in the spreadsheet. They all become 0 too. How friendly. And that's a leap of faith assumption. So my claim is that we should celebrate finding out the truth of that number right now by building a minimum viable product. If we have a free trial sign up in our business, we need to start signing up people for the free trial right now, today, immediately. Because let's say the number is actually 0. Wouldn't you want to know that as soon as possible? Now, most entrepreneurs are afraid to do this step. They don't want to build a minimum viable product because they're afraid, well, what if I get bad news? What if it really is 0? Won't that be bad? And I'm saying, isn't it better to have bad news that's true rather than good news that we just made up? Like, then we'll actually know where we are. We call that establishing the baseline. For each of those assumptions, let's just go find out what they are right now. And then we can celebrate even if we have bad news, because at least now we know what the heck is going on. And we can move into learning milestone number 2, tuning the engine, trying iteration by iteration through build, measure, learn, trying to get those baseline numbers to move up to the ideal that was laid out in that business plan spreadsheet. And then, regardless of whether we're making progress or not, we can achieve milestone number 3, which is have a meeting to decide whether to pivot or persevere. Now, I'll leave you with one last suggestion, and then we'll take some questions. I think there are mics set up so you can line up if you'd like. Most of the time when we have a meeting to decide whether to pivot, it's a pretty grim situation, okay? It's like the 11th hour. We have a board meeting tomorrow. We're running out of money. Everything's going to hell, and we got to have something to show, like ASAP. Does that sound familiar to anybody, right? So the roof is on fire. The walls are caving in. We're about to die. Let's have a conversation about whether to pivot. Not exactly an environment that is conducive to the most calm, rational, clear, strategic thinking, right? So here's my suggestion. If we know for sure that we're going to fail, let's just schedule the pivot meeting in advance. Let's just say every 6 weeks, every 8 weeks, whatever the right time period is, let's just have a meeting, the pivot or persevere meeting, where we can decide if we're on track or not. And not only will that allow us to have meetings that are a lot calmer and a lot less, you know, crazy, but we can also then start to work backwards from, well, gosh, if I'm 8 weeks away from a meeting where I'll have to decide if my current strategy is working, what information would I want to have in the room at the time in order to figure out if my strategy is working or not? And then we can say, well, is the work that I'm doing today actually helping me get that information, or is it just feeding my ego and making me feel good? Like, am I working on a press release today to do a bunch of press, to get a bunch of numbers? Is that actually going to help me figure out if my strategy is working? I say no. Instead, we want to move away from the vanity metrics that we can just juice anytime we want to what we call actionable metrics. And just to give you a flavor of what that feels like, when we were first building InView, after we launched the product and, you know, did that initial pivot, we spent $5 a day on Google AdWords. Okay, that was our full marketing budget. That's how you know I'm crappy at marketing, because I thought that was an adequate budget. No real marketing person would ever settle for that. But in those days, Google AdWords cost a minimum bid of 5 cents a click. So $5 a day bought us 100 clicks every single day. That's 100 human beings trying our product, and I thought, sure, like half of them will buy it. This is going to be great. But any of you who have done direct marketing will know that's ridiculous. What actually happened is that every day, basically, for months, we made one sale. So we had a 1% conversion rate day in, day out. And that was like getting a new report card every day that said, hey, here you go. You got 1%, 1%, 1%. But what started to make us crazy is that every day we were making the product better. And I started to feel paranoid. I was like, wait a minute. Did today's customers get on a conference call with yesterday's customers and be like, hey, how many of you bought the product? One? Okay, because it was so consistent. But what actually was happening is the work we were doing every day was not affecting customer behavior at all. It didn't matter. It was all waste. And that was really hard because as an engineer, I'm trained to make the product, you know, go faster, perform better, add features. As a designer, I'm trained to make the product easier to use. But making a product that people don't want easier to use just makes it easier for them to realize they don't want it. So it's not like having a regular job where incremental work yields incremental benefit. So that's what I'm talking about. We got to figure out what work are we doing every day that's actually helping us learn whether we're on track. And if we're not, let's have the courage to actually do the pivot and to stop wasting people's time. Now, I left a bunch of questions unanswered today. Like, for example, how do you know when to pivot? What is the relationship between vision, strategy, and product? What specifically should we measure? Of course, my very favorite question, is it possible that we can go faster even as we grow, or is bureaucracy our inevitable destination? Now, to be honest, I left these questions unanswered intentionally because I hear this really awesome book that just came out, which is, of course, available on Amazon and at the South By bookstore even as we speak, so I hope that you will check it out. But that is not your only opportunity to learn more. Tomorrow, in the Hilton on the fourth floor, we are doing a lean startup track at South By all day from 9:30 to 6. It is going to be awesome. So I hope that you will give us a chance to check it out. Steve Blank will be speaking. He'll be one of our keynotes, as will Scott Cook, the founder of Intuit, Todd Park, who was just named by President Obama today as the Chief Technology Officer of the United States, and a bunch of case studies, Etsy, Airbnb, Hipmunk, a lot of cool companies. So I hope that you will come check it out. And that's not all. I also have a special offer just for you. See, the problem with South By, okay, let's just be honest, is that we do a lot of talking. Okay, but lean startup is all about doing, and so it puts me in this horrible position where I'm, you know, here I am talking to you, we're talking, we'll be talking all day tomorrow, and that's important, case studies are important, learning is important, but I want us also to remember that entrepreneurship is about doing, and so I teamed with my friends at AppSumo to create a bundle of products, hosting, analytics, everything you would need to get started building a new product, and we are going to run a contest. You can find out more at the track tomorrow. Please do check it out. It is like $7,000 worth of stuff for one low price, which I actually don't know, but it's a really good deal. So I hope that you will check it out. I just want to say before we close, thank you very, very much for being here. Thank you, Steve, for a very, very kind introduction, and I would love to take some questions. Please, if you do any of this and it works or it doesn't work, be in touch. This is how to get in touch with me. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it. Thank you. All right, is there a question? Hi.
Hi, Eric.
Hello.
My name is Adriano. I'm an entrepreneur in residence at StarTex, the Stanford accelerator.
Cool.
I have two questions for the price of one, like Groupon. So the first one is, so I read your book, of course, and I loved it, this one. Yeah,
thank
great
you so
book.
Much.
Here's the thing. I would like to make sure that I understood what you mean by vanity metrics.
Okay.
By taking an example of today, not to embarrass you, but just to make sure that I understood, Google Plus. So those guys are saying that they have last figures like 23 million users.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a vanity metric to you? Yes?
Oh, yes.
Perfect.
Yes,
okay.
And let me explain why, just for everyone who doesn't understand. Google's been announcing all these users. And now, listen, vanity metrics doesn't mean something's wrong. It just means we have no idea, right? That could be 23 million people who tried Google Plus one time and they're done. Or it could be one guy who created 23 million accounts. Okay? We literally cannot tell the difference between A plus and F, right? That's the problem. Now, internally, you know for sure Google is using other metrics to figure out whether they're getting engagement, the metrics they really care about. But they put 23 million in their press release to try to make their competitors feel bad. That's what vanity metrics are for. But that's basically just lying, right? Because they put those numbers out there because they're like, yeah, our competitors can't tell anything important from that. That just sounds good. So yeah, vanity
thanks.
Metric.
Thanks
second
for
question,
being so
yeah.
frank.
No problem.
So it is.
Sorry to my friends at Google. It's not, okay. It's not personal.
So second thing is, I really loved your book, and I'm sort of in trouble because I also love the thinking of another great person called Steve Jobs. And what Steve Jobs said was that basically the user doesn't know what he wants.
Yeah.
So it was a lot about consumer engineering. And to me, this kind of two ideas, I'm fascinated by both of them, but there is a huge contradiction. How mm-hmm. do you explain it? Thanks.
Thank you very much for that question. If I accomplish only one thing with my life, and it is to resolve this conundrum, this fight between the visionary co-founder and the operational co-founder. If that is the only thing I achieve in my whole life, I will die very satisfied, because this used to drive me crazy, right? I was the operational, I had a brilliant visionary CEO, and we would have these fights. I'd be like, we gotta test, we gotta get out there, A-B test, we gotta find out what customers want, and my visionary would be like, no, customers don't know what they want, so we can't ask them. And the problem is, it's like your classic false dichotomy. We were both right, and so we could never resolve the argument. And here's how I'm going to try to convince you that that's true. Imagine I was a physicist, and I got up here, and I was like, I need to find out the structure of atoms. I got to really understand electrons and protons. I'm like, oh, shoot. Electrons don't know what they want, and I can't do a focus group. Oh, well, physics be damned. I'm going home. You'd be like, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. But if you think about what the argument we're having, that's just like, well, I either test things or I, you know, don't listen to customers at all. But it's like, no. Our goal is not to listen to customers. That's not an intrinsic good thing. We can do focus groups all day long and learn nothing. We're trying to turn entrepreneurship into a science. And that's actually really hard. I heard somebody say, I can't remember who it was, somebody said, if entrepreneurship, you know, was a science, then anybody could do it. And I was like, that doesn't make sense. Science is a science, and almost nobody can do it. It's really hard. No. If we want to think scientifically, what we want to do is measure how customers behave and then use that to refine our vision over time. That's why a pivot is a change in strategy, not a change in vision. When we get contradictory data, we don't just give up and go home. We stay true to the vision. Using the data to plot our destination is like getting into your car and turning on GPS and being like, GPS, where do I want to go? It doesn't know. It's just a robot. Okay, you have to tell it where you want to go, but if you run into an obstacle, it can help you find a new route. Now, everybody wants to be Steve Jobs, I understand. I mean, every entrepreneur in their heart is like, one day, that's going to be me. And the Steve Jobs that we admire intuitively is the guy on stage launching the iPad, right? And you're like, oh, I got this crazy thing. Everyone's like, that's stupid, that'll never work. 5 seconds later, oh my God, the president's calling because he wants an iPad, okay? That's fun. But that is not the Steve Jobs I admire. I mean, listen, I think that's fun. But the Steve Jobs I admire is the one that had the courage to launch the Apple One. Anyone ever seen an Apple One in person? Anybody? Very few folks. It is a rare device. It's actually not even one in the Computer History Museum. That's how rare they are, because they sold so few. It was a tiny kit that was sold only at the Homebrew Computer Club in Palo Alto. It did not sell that many units. It was the first computer that Jobs and Wozniak put together. Now, to me, that is an act of entrepreneurial vision and daring. To have the vision of the power of personal computing and yet be willing to build a crappy minimum viable product that did almost nothing, sell it in kit parts only at the Homebrew Computer Club. So those of us who want to be the next Steve Jobs, you know, do you really have the courage to put your vision into such a primitive form and let that be your first step? You know, that's what I admire. Yes?
Hey, Eric. Eddie Stover. I work in a technology department at Team One Advertising in El Segundo.
Nice to
and
meet you.
I know that probably about the first 6 months of a startup are the most important for that startup.
Okay.
Would you have any advice based on your experience for what like a golden number of people would be during that 6 months?
To work in the company, you mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think there's an objectively right answer here. You know, if you look at the data, it's all over the map. Generally, people believe solo teams do worse than multi-party teams, but if it's too many. I've had the privilege of basically working in five-person teams with a, you know, cross-section of skills, and so that's, you know, that's just the model I have, is, you know, a small committed team. Large teams don't do as well as small teams. Small teams do better than solo practitioners and consultants and that kind of thing. If you want to know the actual mathematically correct answer, though, you should read a great new book called Founders Dilemmas by Noam Wasserman at HBS. He actually has a data set that is pretty powerful for just helping you understand what the consequences and trade-offs are in the different founding decisions you made. So I recommend that book. Next question, is everybody over here? I can't really see because of the lights. Just ask.
Yeah, my name is Asaf, and I'm the co-founder of a startup, and I also read your book and loved
you.
It and trying to apply some of the principles with the startup. And one of the concepts I'm kind of struggling with is the concept of the MVP, because it pretty much kind of drives you to take a feature you have in your mind and strip it down to the minimum that can still put your assumptions into a test.
Yeah.
Now, then what happens if you put this MVP out and there's not a huge take-up, maybe it's a complete failure?
Yeah.
And then how do you know if this is because you had the wrong assumption or because the product was so stripped down of feature? If you add a few more that you originally believed in, there could be better metrics.
Yeah, because thank you for that question. That's really important. No, and this is really right. One experiment can never tell you anything. So minimum viable product singular is misleading in that way. I've seen people do an MVP where they got a 0% conversion rate and they were like, oh my God, my idea sucks. And then they realized the problem was that the sign up button wasn't connected properly. So if you push the button, it didn't do anything. So of course they had a 0% sign up rate, but it was actually a really good idea. So how do you know if it's an implementation problem or the idea problem? You can never know from one test. You have to keep iterating and keep changing and keep trying until you convince yourself that even though you've tried 50 different things that all seemed aligned with the strategy, you still couldn't get people to sign up. And that's going to require, that's when the customer interviews and trying to figure out, why won't people sign up for my damn thing? Like, that's when that kind of insight can be really important. But so it requires a series of experiments until you finally reveal what's going on. But here's the other thing. Implicit in what you said is a fear, and I would like to help release the fear. Most of us are afraid if we put out the crappy MVP, something bad will happen. And as long as you don't launch in the press, I promise you, nothing bad will happen. Because here's the thing, if nobody uses your product, you don't have to apologize to anybody. That's actually great. Most entrepreneurs I know are terrified that customers will try the product and yell at them and say, this is horrible. How could you have launched with features A and B but not feature C? You're such an idiot. But think about what a great outcome that would be. Okay, that means you built the product, you know how to reach customers, you got them to try it, you got them to sign up, you got them to use it. They used it enough that they care enough to tell you what they think, and they agree with you that feature C is the most important thing. That's like getting 10 things right. Congratulations. We should all be so lucky to ever have that experience. Most of the time, you ship your MVP and nobody cares. And it doesn't matter what features are in it. That's what we're trying to avoid. So it's actually great news. This is controversial, but I believe there is no penalty for launching too early. But there is a penalty in launching too late. Now, again, the word launch has to be understood correctly. It doesn't mean blow up in the press, get it big fast, get a lot of users. It means allow customers to use your product, and if they don't like it, you don't have to apologize. Next.
I work in UX and design, and sometimes designers can get a little, like, really focused on some color or button placement. How do you keep people from, like, getting so micro-focused on things and, like, these A-B tests, like, you know, you hear about Google, they're, like, 30
colors,
whatever
yeah.
shades of blue for something, and it's like, that's stupid, but how do you,
yeah.
like, keep everyone from doing that? Because it's the easy thing. It's like, oh, well, we'll test this versus this, but
yeah.
strategically.
My question is, what do you learn from the 44 shades of blue test?
Conversion rate.
You learn which shade of blue slightly optimizes conversion.
Right.
Who cares? Here's the problem. When I say build, measure, learn, a lot of people are like, oh, optimization. But I didn't say the word optimization. I didn't say it one time. It is not our goal. Big companies that have millions of hits every day, you know, Amazon trying to improve the checkout rate of their buy now button, like, wait, a tenth of a percent improvement in conversion rate is like a huge deal. That's probably hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue to Amazon. Okay, that's who optimization is for. For us as entrepreneurs, if we're worrying about a tenth of a percent here and there, we're in the weeds. Nobody cares. That's not important. We need to figure out, is our macro assumption about our strategy, is it actually any good, or are we doomed? Okay, those are the kind of tests we want to write. So the first thing we have to do is what I call measure the macro. No matter what the test we run is, we should only ever use the 5 to 10 most important metrics we care about for the business to evaluate its success. And this is really hard, especially for people who've been trained in optimization. That means if you're going to change the color of a button, I will not allow you to measure the conversion rate of that button. Who cares about the click-through rate? We care about, will customers sign up, buy, do they have engagement with our product, what's the lifetime value, right? The key top-line metrics that we really care about. If those metrics don't move, the experiment was a failure, period. Now, that doesn't sound very good, because they but the click-through rate went up, but if it doesn't change customer behavior, we don't care. Now, our mantra for designers is a good design is one that changes customer behavior for the better. Just keep repeating that over and over again. That's how we learn. Now, the problem with product development, the curse of product development, is that sometimes tiny things make a big difference and sometimes huge things make no difference. And we have to learn to tell which is which. So I'm not saying you can't run small experiments, but if you're like, but I need to know the click-through rate because I don't think it'll show up in the macro metrics, it's like, wait, then why are we running that experiment? That's actually a waste of time. We're not going to learn anything from it. Does that help at all?
Yeah, totally. Thanks.
Thank you.
The balance between marketing and product.
Yes.
It could be a great, you can have a good product, great, you know, with bad marketing, you know, that whole thing. if you have a great product but you don't make a good offer, you don't have it marketed right, how do you tell whether it was the marketing or the product? You know, a book. It can be so lousy, then some guy comes along, changes the title, makes it sexy, gives it a hook, something like that. How do you tell if it's a product or if it's your marketing?
Thanks for that question. There is no distinction between product and marketing in an early stage startup. Those functional disciplines are an artifact of big companies. Now, I don't believe in departments. So I don't believe there's such a thing as a product, as a development department or a marketing department. I think those distinctions are completely ridiculous. In an early stage company, there's only the customer's experience, whatever that experience is. Customers can't differentiate between product and marketing. They just know, I like it or I don't like it. So that's the first thing. We have to just blow up that distinction. Now, I'm glad you used the idea of a book, because when I published this book, I really used these ideas to test and build it, you know, for the long time before the book came out. And just to give you a flavor of it, you know, people are like, well, were you testing the content of the book or the marketing of the book? And I was like, yes, exactly. That's exactly what we were doing. So for example, you know, one of the big questions for a book is, what should the title and subtitle be? And people, you know, and in order to test that, we built a replica website, our own Amazon.com, because we wanted to take pre-orders a year before the book would be listed on Amazon. And we were actually taking customers' actual money. Anybody here actually buy from that early experiment? Any early adopters in here? Can I just say thank you very much? These people were crazy. They gave us their money before we even know how much the book was going to cost. So we couldn't even charge them correctly, and we had to ship them book. It was a huge pain in the neck, and I'm sure they had a horrible experience too. But all we really wanted to know is, first of all, did anybody really want this book? And secondly, we then were able to test different titles, different covers, different marketing messages about what would actually cause conversion rates to go up. Now, that sounds like marketing, right? But actually what we're testing is the way the book should be positioned. And the difference between a book about, for example, product development versus entrepreneurship versus corporate innovation, that's actually three completely different books. And there's no way you can have the same book with a different title. That actually makes no sense. So we did this experimentation while the book was actually being written so that we could constantly go back and forth and take ideas from the book, workshop them in settings like this, in small workshops, on the website, constantly testing and refining. And the reason why that MVP is better than a survey, better than a focus group, better than market research, is whenever we had a question we needed to actually talk to customers about, we never had to ask, like, I wonder who's our target customer? Who should we talk to? We had a list of people who had proven they cared about this topic. And so we could reach out to those people and have them read sample chapters, and we could have them do tests and figure out, hey, if you read this chapter, will we read the next chapter, et cetera. So does that give you a little bit of flavor of the marketing is the product is the marketing? Thank you. I think we got time for one or two more.
My question is about most of the ways that you describe using this kind of fast turnaround and validated learning is, seems to be, you're talking about it in the context of in-house design and development within the startup. I'm a creative director at a small firm, and we work with a lot of startups, and I really like the philosophy behind validated learning, but at the same time, our kind of the core of our financial structure and you know, contracts, yeah, and scope of work makes that hard to kind of work in that kind of collaborative effort. Have you had any experience with hiring people, yes, outside?
Yes. Yeah, I got it.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, this is a solvable problem, but it requires a massive change that you're not going to want to do. So my prediction is you will not change and you will not solve this problem, but I will tell you anyway. And I'm telling you that because I want you to really understand the current model that you currently use works very well. It allows you to make a lot of money by charging for your time and effort for deliverables. And if you want to get out of the deliverables business, you're going to have to go into a new business, and that can be really scary. So most agencies just do not want to do that. But remember when I talked about accountability being the key? Here, the accountability is from your client to you. They are the ones holding you accountable for the thing you agreed to do. And as long as that agreement is denominated in stuff, in making stuff, then you will always be in the deliverables business, and you will always be arguing about whether you made good enough stuff. The only way to get out of the deliverables business is to renegotiate those contracts to be denominated in validated learning. So you have to say, listen, we will achieve business results together and share the proceeds. And that, you know, not as secure a business model, much riskier, like it's not very fun. But once you have that accountability set up, then we can talk about, there's a lot of specific process things around how do you get you and the client co-located so that you can learn together? How can you set up experiments and hypotheses together? But None of that will work. If you try to just be faster, be more iterative, but ultimately the accountability is around delivering stuff, it won't work. I'll just tell you one anecdote from a design agency I will not name. A very famous design agency brought me in to work on a project, and they had a client who had commissioned them to build for them a room of the future to see what the future of their industry was going to look like. And this was like, I don't know, 10 years ago, and they built this room of the future, and they had it, you know, in their headquarters somewhere in LA or something, and there's this room where you can see the future. And they came back to the design agency and they said, oh, we're so excited. We did that. You guys nailed it. You said exactly, if you go to that room of the future, we took all our executives through it, we love it. You really predicted what the future was going to be. We're so excited. Thank you for that. We want to recommission you. And they're like, oh, great. Did you actually do any of the, you know, build any of the products that we recommended to you in the room of the future? They're like, oh, no. No, we didn't. But you guys nailed it. We had this great room of the future. And so they got paid for making the room of the future. And this time the client came back and said, could you do a new project for us, see the next 10 years, but this time we'd like to, you know, actually build some stuff. Can you help us? And the company was really in trouble. I mean, the agency was really designed to help them build another room of the future. But how do you hold the agency accountable for building actual products? The agency doesn't build anything. The company builds them. So if I give you a design spec and then your engineers screw it up, whose fault is that? So we have to get out of that whole paradigm. We have to really blow that up to say, no, we will take your product development and our design team and we will work together to figure out what actually works and be jointly accountable for those business results. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thanks.
Good luck. All right, this will be the last question.
This is actually kind of a piggyback on the last question maybe as far as your answer goes, but as you move out of the early stage startups, put your operations hat on, and where does outsourcing come into play? Is there economies of scale you can get from outsourcing any basic infrastructure? Or not core competence, but what are your thoughts on that?
I am not a big fan of outsourcing because what is today's irrelevant technology is tomorrow's core competency because the world is changing too fast. And it's very easy, you know, to be an old IBM, outsource your operating system because who cares? Oops, just kidding. That was the most important thing in the universe. That keeps happening to companies over and over again because when we try to analyze what's important, analysis is what gets us in trouble. Now, in the book, I try to make a more nuanced argument than that for what I call the portfolio of work. Every company is actually doing multiple kinds of work at the same time. And as managers, we have to manage that whole portfolio. So R&D versus, you know, strategic investment versus keeping the lights on versus investing in infrastructure. And technically speaking, in that last category, the kind of infrastructure of legacy products, of stuff that's no longer core to our strategy, that's where you want to focus on outsourcing. But to be honest, I think generally, if we're really focused on building an organization that's built to learn, outsourcing is going to get in the way of that. Now, from a policy point of view, it means investing in entrepreneurship is always going to be intrinsically good because insourcing is a necessary part of entrepreneurship. That means the jobs get created here in the USA, so go startup visa. Anyway, that's going to have to be our last question. I just want to say one more time, thank you all so, so much for being here. Please, if you just close your eyes for 1 second and visualize, okay, if something I said to you maybe sounded good today or something made sense or you had an idea today that you're like, oh, that's actually what the guy talked about was stupid, but I got a better idea, whatever it is, please just take a moment and visualize something you could do tomorrow. Okay, by the end of tomorrow, even though you're at South By, even though you got parties to go to, but what could you do in one day that would start to move you on this path so that this can be more than just about talking, it can be about doing. Thank you all very much. Like I said, please be in touch. Thank you.